Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from North Dallas. Welcome to the show, Eric Rice.
Thank you so much, Victor. Great to be here.
Well, great to have you here. Now, there's many different forms of real estate. When we typically talk about real estate, people think of, you know, little greenhouses and things like that, like in the game Monopoly. But you come from the world of oil and gas, which is another form of real estate where the value is buried under the ground. Before we dive into the details, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So I'm a career entrepreneur. I've had many businesses in technology. Before moving to Dallas, I was in Southern California, originally from Chicago. Started out managing money and on the floor sector of the Chicago financial district. I was a money manager for a couple of the big houses for many years. Went into my own businesses for years, and when I moved to Texas, I had actually walked away from one of my businesses, left it in California, and when I got here, I wanted to find some place or some sector to work in to bring kind of a more relevant operational experience, at least on the. On the capital raise side. I've been doing this for a very long time. And I looked at what was happening around the world, what was happening in our country, and a lot of different oil and gas companies before I finally settled in here because of the model that we have here at King Operating. But the whole primary purpose was, if I was going to raise capital, I wanted to help fight against taxation, which is a really big problem that's getting worse in 2024. So I decided that we were at a deficit, a standstill at the energy production side of things here in America. And at that point in time, I took a look into oil and gas. I found King. We offer something very unique, which is ownership of the leases, which most oil and gas deals don't offer. And for me, it was a three-pronged approach. I could help investors, you know, lower their taxable income, increase their monthly income, and still focus on a multiple on capital earned. So that brought me here about 20 months ago. So I've been here for almost 2 years, and it's just been a great experience watching. Getting thank you cards in the summer for the reduction people have in taxes, and then watching the drilling process unfold in our fund. So previous to this, I was actually in quantum biology. That was my last business. So oil and gas, a little simpler energy form than quantum energy, but at the same time, just as useful to the world and something we need more of. We need more domestic oil and gas production. Globalization has made oil a very interesting sector.
Fascinating. Now, when we talk about oil and gas, there's many different ways to play in that. There is what's called the working interest. There's the non-working interest. And then there's the lease ownership, where you're primarily relying on a royalty stream. Why don't you break that down and define a little bit more what those three sectors are?
So as far as the investment goes, there's, you know, for the tax write-off, we have benefits in oil and gas that other places don't. So obviously depreciation is involved in any sort of real estate and equipment machinery. We have tangible and intangible drilling costs that add to that. So we can offer our client base 100% tax write-off for their investment in the fund against all forms of income. And then, of course, we get into the drilling process. And the drilling process for us creates a model where all of our production is generally sold within a few days after the bins are full with oil. So when that happens, we actually distribute 80% of our net profits out to our shareholders every month. So that offers a monthly income stream, which also has great tax benefits. And the ownership of the leases is kind of the third and biggest benefit of this. And of course, there's no guarantee on it, just like with any investment. But as you start drilling oil and you start proving up land, what we're doing is we're taking land that is adjacent to proven acreage, and we are proving it up. So we're extending the proven acreage grid or map, if you will. And every time that we pull oil out of the ground in certain parts of our properties, we're increasing the value of that lease by, you know, 3-4x on occasion, sometimes larger. No mystery behind oil and gas is that the more we know where oil is, but the more easily you can repeat successful wells, the faster you accelerate the value of the lease. And in most deals, and I say most outside of our company, I don't really know of anyone. There's some copycats coming up. But in most oil and gas deals, you generally get a tax write-off, and then you get monthly or quarterly income. You get what's called a wellbore assignment, which means that you basically have the rights to a percentage of the sale of the extracted hydrocarbons, whereas the lease gives you the entire reserves below the surface. So when you look at the difference between the two, having a revenue stream from the sale of oil and gas is great, but once you start selling more and proving the land has value and will yield, generally the oil and gas companies make a fortune on the leaseholds. They will get you into a fund, start producing oil, pay you every month or every quarter, and then essentially they'll make a fortune selling that lease to another operator who will also honor your contract.
So are you focused primarily on conventional play or what's called tight oil, where you're essentially fracking because this is embedded deep within the shale and doesn't flow quite so easily?
Well, we look at both. So any operator is going to certainly look at conventional or unconventional. I would say that we're more focused on unconventional at this point in time, because that's where the resale value is. The conventional plays, vertical wells, you know, sticking a straw in the ground, those are great, but they don't produce as much. So a good vertical well will get you 100 barrels a day, whereas a good horizontal, though it'll cost you, you know, three or four times more to drill, a good horizontal will get you, you know, 8, 9, 10x of a normal vertical. So we're focused very, very, very heavily. I'd say 70% of our portfolio is unconventional frack operations, but we certainly do mix in the conventional cheap well that produces just to spike some of the income along the way. But we're primarily focused in on more of the horizontal space.
Now, when we talk about oil and gas, we can't have a conversation without talking about the risks. And there are many, even things as simple as an inadequate cement job on the casing or something like that can allow water intrusion to come into the well and things like that. So, you know, once you've got water in your well, you almost need to start again in many cases. How do you mitigate those risks?
Well, I mean, the risk of water is 100%. So every well that's ever been drilled in general pulls out water. I mean, it's one of our biggest expenses in oil and gas is the disposal of salt water that comes from underneath the ground, very old oceanic water. So we have to dispose of that quite frequently. Water breach in a well is a pretty rare thing. In any sort of construction, which, you know, real estate builds up, oil and gas builds down. And when you look at any of those plays, there's certainly a risk of machinery, equipment default, human error, miscalculation, things like that. But we've been doing this for 26 years, so we don't have too many water breaches into a well. And with fracking, you're pumping, you know, 400 to 500,000 barrels of water into a reservoir anyway to create fractures. So we're very used to pumping out water. You generally get water for 2 or 3 weeks before the oil starts flowing on its own. So it's a very common thing along the way, very common. But we're a portfolio builder. So, you know, in general, your oil and gas deal is going to be for 1, 2, or 3 wells, $5 million, $10 million raise. If you miss on one of them, the fund is generally dead. Whereas we were in the middle of a $200 million raise, you know, drilling 40 or 50 wells over the course of a 3 to 5 year period. So we're certainly going to have hangups like anyone else, but this coming year, we're going to have 2 rigs running at the same time for the better part of Q2. So for us, you know, we are certainly going to have operational issues and cracks in concrete and piping issues along the way. We're very experienced at dealing with it and managing it. And more importantly, we use as high sophistication sensors as we can to determine that will be a possible outcome before it happens. But it does happen. It does certainly happen in our industry. So we focus on building a larger portfolio and de-risking each individual well.
One of the things that's sometimes difficult to model financially, because of course you can't really predict the future, we definitely know that tight wells have this inverse hyperbolic decline curve where you get maximum output pretty much the day that you start getting production. And then that declines usually 85% within the first year. Now you could still have a 20 or 25 year life on that well, but it continues to decline to a trickle after not that long. Where are you seeing the break-even points from an investment standpoint? Is that in the 12-month window, in the 24-month window? Where are you seeing the break-even on the investment?
Well, you're talking about a portfolio of 50 with each well being different. We work in multiple basins at the same time. So your basins are a real good indicator of the rapid decline curve. There are certain formations that are well known that you will drill and get 1,200 barrels per day for about, you know, 30 days maximum, and then it'll dip down to the 100 or 90 barrel a day. So that certainly is common. It's impossible to predict. You can have a good forewarning from past performance in the same reservoirs. But when you drill in different formations, there are definitely times in a fund that you want to drill for those types of wells because you need immediate production. If you can get it cheaply, that's not a bad return. But we really focus more on reservoirs that have like the Wolfcamp in Texas, the Spraberry in Texas, some of the Chartwell formations. Those formations are generally ones that take a while to get started and flow for quite some time. But flush production happens in every well. You're generally going to get maximum flow back for the first, few weeks to a month, and then the decline curve will begin, which is why it's important to invest if you're an investor investing in an oil and gas fund that's focused on building a portfolio. So as decline begins to happen in one well, flush production begins in another, and you continue to drill. And some of these rapid decline curves that you'll see in our wells, that they are generally offset by new production. So being in a 1 to 3 well investment is going to be very risky because you do see that quite a bit. And it's important to have new flush production behind it and to balance out your wells. Just like any, an oil and gas fund with the wells that we drill is very similar to an asset allocation in a portfolio. We want to have some big flush production, rapid decline. We want to have some slow flush production with long-term life, shelf life. And you mix those together and you've got a really, really good fund. But at the end of the day, the majority of the money made in oil and gas, again, comes from selling the leases, proving the land. It's not necessarily the production over a 30-year period. It's generally in, in the first 3 to 5 years, can you prove that that lease is worth more today than it was in the past? And when we get into 24, late 24, 25, and 26, oil production is going to be a very big issue. So there's a very good opportunity at this time. But you manage the hyper-accelerated decline curve by making sure you're drilling new wells with new flush production behind them.
Talk a little bit about the valuation of leases as it relates to the spot price. For example, in the U.S., a lot of the pricing is indexed to the West Texas Intermediate Light Sweet Crude. How does that affect the value of a lease minute to minute, hour to hour, when in one respect, Mother Nature doesn't care what's happening in the commodities market? There's just oil in the ground and it's there until it gets pulled out. How does that relationship work?
Oh, it's a very, very tightly interwoven relationship. So we actually had some leases that have a lot of value that we wanted to sell in early 2023 and in late 2022, but the price of natural gas and oil were not in the right area. So the value of the lease, the way that it's calculated by an acquirer, so another oil and gas company or private equity company, they're going to look at our 3D seismic and our reserve report to determine how many hydrocarbons are below the surface on that plot of land. Then they're going to look at the engineering capabilities, engineering due diligence, and be able to say, well, we're doing it the right way, or we can do it better than you're doing. And that's kind of the baseline of whether or not someone would be interested in a lease. And then the negotiation of price happens at the spot price. So if oil is at $100 a barrel, you're going to get, $100 a barrel multiplied by your reserve report and your engineering probabilities. And if it's at $60 a barrel, the same thing happens. So the spot price for oil and gas leases is extremely important. It's very tightly woven. So you certainly don't want to sell property in $60 a barrel oil times, and you certainly don't want to hold on to them in $100, $120 a barrel times. There's certainly a very tight, close relationship between spot price and lease.
There's a view that the U.S. is reaching what's called peak oil, which means that we're probably close to the maximum national production, after which it just gets harder and harder and harder to pull oil out of the ground and maintain those production levels. What would be the impact of being past peak oil post 25, 26, 27, and how would that influence the investment thesis?
Well, the past peak oil comes from the same media sources that have been telling you that the world will end in the next 2 days, that inflation is at 2% while our grocery bills are 20% higher than they were last year. The same ones that tell us we have 500,000 jobs and 3 months later adjusted down to 200,000 jobs. The fact of the matter is that in the peak oil production, I'll give you an example. In 2016, CNN of all places produced an article, which I'll happily share the link, stating that the largest oil reserves in the world reside on American soil. That's maybe the last time they told the truth, to be honest with you. As soon as Trump got into office, everything was green energy immediately while he's been talking about, drilling. So the understanding of where we are with oil is really, really far apart from reality and from narrative. So peak oil, is probably being reached in a certain region of the world, and it's not America. We have not even come close to touching our reserves. We have more regulations against us drilling than any other nation in the world. What you're watching in OPEC and OPEC Plus in the Middle East is probably, you're probably getting close to their reserves being tapped in that region of the world. Of course, you don't hear that. Why in the world will they voluntarily drop the price and production in the last 2 years if they were able to produce 5 million barrels more and raise the price? Wouldn't you do that? That conversation, I also hear from the administration that's out there today saying, you know, America's producing more oil this year than they did last year. I'm going to disagree with that on one basis. We have about 90 rigs that haven't been used. So if we're producing more oil today than we did 4 years ago, tell me how we're doing it with 100 less rigs. Do we have the greatest wells ever drilled in American soil?
Yeah, clearly not.
There's a very big disconnect between reality and media narrative, and that extends into just about everything. So in that scenario, reaching peak oil production, we look at 70, 75 deals a month. We see 3D seismic on about half of those. And the amount of reserves that we see just in Texas alone are staggering. They're just not being tapped. It's a well-known actual scientific fact that between Texas and Alaska and parts of Canada, you have enough oil and gas between Texas and Alaska to power every airplane, vehicle, and home and manufacturing facility on planet Earth for the next 600 years. So the narrative behind oil and gas is generally used to manipulate price. You know, so if we think we're at peak production, you could either say we have a lot of production and lower the price for a campaign, or you could look at it and say we're at peak production. You know, the price is going to go up because there's no more oil. If you remember in the 30s, Rockefeller, who basically built the entire oil industry, he told us that we would be out of oil by 1970. Well, we still have more oil than we know what to do with on planet Earth. So the narrative and reality breach is a big problem in this country and all around the world, especially when it comes to economics, which you would think economics would be a black and white discussion, but it's just simply not anymore.
One of the misconceptions, you talked about it, one misconception, I think another misconception about the oil industry is that it's actually dominated by the majors, when in fact, if you look at the vast majority of the oil industry, it's thousands of mom and pop operated businesses that are out there doing the work in the field on a day-to-day basis. And the major oil companies actually only represent a small fraction of the industry. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, no, that's extremely accurate. Yeah, that's another area. And it's kind of like that in most places. All we hear about is the big companies or the big employers. Well, they're not. Small business employs about 80% of this country. So if you look at it from the oil and gas perspective, we're really a prime candidate to describe that. I mean, we're a family-owned 26-year-old business. We've been drilling wells all throughout the country for years. Our primary function in the marketplace is to flip. So what we do is we find probable acreage, prove it out, and then sell it to one of these majors who then generally hire companies like ours to operate. You know, when you look at Shell and Exxon and ConocoPhillips and some of these larger companies, what they're really good at is they're good at acquisition, at M&A. So what they do is they look for leases. It's kind of the business model that we're right in. So they look for leases and they watch them. So they will look for someone who buys out a lease like ours and then proves it up, all public knowledge, all public information, and then they start making offers on it. So they'll buy the land, control the production and the flow of commodity. And at the same time, what they will do with that is they'll hire an operating company to do the drilling for them. This has really been brought to light in the last couple of years with every major across the board basically saying we're looking at 0 to 5% returns for our clients over the next 5 years, which basically means they're using this period in time, especially when oil prices were high, you know, in the hundreds, like when the Ukraine-Russia war broke out. They weren't drilling oil. They were using the profits from their existing oil to buy out shares, to buy back shares. So you're absolutely correct. The oil and gas industry, you know, small companies like ours, independent operators, are the ones that prove up acreage to be purchased by the majors. And then they generally hire us as an operating company to maintain production. That's exactly right.
Now, I know we're going a little bit long here. Let's talk a little bit about gas, because oftentimes when you drill an oil well, especially in shale, you get some associated gas with that. And if the gas infrastructure isn't in place, you're often ending up flaring off the gas at the wellhead. Talk a little bit about that. And is your play strictly oil? Is it oil and gas? If you have a gas well, what do you do? All of that.
Yeah, we're oil and gas. So we do have some leases that we drill and some pay zones. Like we have certain properties where a certain pay zone will be oil, another one will be gas. We'll drill them independently and produce them. But flare gas is a very interesting topic, specifically for me. what we're in general, you flare off what equates to a couple hundred thousand dollars in gas in an oil well. Not a huge amount of money in the grand scheme, but real money. And for years and years, this has just been the practice. And what we're watching right now in the oil and gas space is one of the things we're getting into this year is we're going to, instead of flaring gas, we're going to start capturing that gas. Flare gas is generally a waste and an expense, but a lot of Bitcoin mine companies are trying to acquire flare gas. So you're watching the environmentalist promote against oil and gas, which is essentially promoting against computing power. Most people don't realize that right now, the just to run the cloud for our phones and our computers takes about two times the amount of energy requirement of the nation of Japan, the entire country, the third largest economy in the world. So we need more energy all across the board. We're not going to replace oil and gas with wind and solar. That's a proven fact at this point. The flare gas part is very interesting because there are a lot of Bitcoin mines that are looking for extra energy for computing power. And a lot of deals are being cut in this sector to stop flaring gas, start capturing it and selling it to the Bitcoin miners.
Fascinating. Well, Eric, if folks want to connect, if they want to learn more, what's the best way?
Well, I'm on Twitter at EA_Rice. I'm not on there very much. I just share stuff. In general, the best way to get a hold of me is on our website. That's at kingoperating.com. And just go ahead and put in that you heard us on your show and get right in touch with us.
Fantastic. Well, great conversation. And for the listeners at home, definitely connect with Eric Rice at kingoperating.com. The link will be in the show notes. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow.